Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It is a great pleasure and honor for me to be allowed to give the opening lecture of this conference. I would like to dedicate my talk to my predecessor, colleague, and long-standing collaborator, Herbert Walter, who passed away just a few days ago. In my talk, I would like to first review the basic, or some of the basic tools and techniques that have allowed or have provided direct time domain access to electronic dynamics on a sub-femtosecond or attosecond time scale. Many of you will probably have heard about this part, might have seen quite a few transparencies quite a few times, so I apologize to all those for that. I hope I will be able to compensate you with the second part devoted to applications, where I'm going to present quite a few results that we obtained very recently. Some of them have not even been written up for publication yet. Let me begin with a mission statement. Hopefully it works. Doesn't really seem to work at the moment. I'm sorry for that. So attosecond physics, as I understand it, aims at gaining insight into the motion of electrons on atomic length scales. Experimentally, this goal is being pursued by developing tools and techniques for direct control and real-time observation of electrons in atoms, molecules, solids, plasmas, and all sorts of systems. You may wonder why actually this goal is being pursued. One could, of course, now come up with quite a few possible shorter or long-term implications. I prefer rather to quote Max Planck as a justification for all these efforts. The greater the detail in which we can pursue nature on any path, the richer and more durable will be the gain that can be derived from our perceptiveness. Just as diffraction and image and microscopy is able to resolve the structure of matter with ever improving resolution down to the atomic scale, and probably sooner or later even down to the subatomic scale, ultrafast spectroscopies allow one to capture short-lived transient states of matter and reconstruct dynamics with an ever improving, ever higher time resolution. As you all know, dictated by the millielectron volt energy spacing of vibrational levels, energy levels in molecules, atoms tend to move to atomic motion, tends to unfold in molecules within the chemical bonds on a time scale of tens to hundreds of femtoseconds. The energy spacing is getting much, much larger as we move to electrons, particularly as we consider electronic motion in ever smaller dimensions, starting from nanostructures down to molecular orbitals and eventually to inner shells. The energy spacing becomes larger and larger, and correspondingly faster becomes the motion. That means that just as atoms, atomic motion requires femtosecond laser pulses to be captured, electronic motion, direct access to electronic motion in a time domain will require ethosecond tools. What do we mean by tools? I would like to remind you that ultrafast control and metrology relies, and this is quite general, applies to any time domain, relies on a signal with a controlled steep temporal gradient. Of course, this signal is also supposed to be able to exert a force to the particle, the motion of which we would like to steer or control with this signal. In modern ultrafast science, the steep control temporal gradient has been provided primarily by electromagnetic waves. In microwave electronics, it is a controlled microwave voltage that has been moved, that has been speeded up down to the picoseconds and is able to drive currents on that time scale and push the limits of electronics down to a few picoseconds. Nonlinear optical techniques exploited by lasers have paved the way to femtosecond pulse generation and metrology down to the few femtosecond regime, which turned out to be a pretty firm limit just set by the wave cycle of light in the wavelength range in the near infrared where the shortest pulses have been generated. In ultrafast optics, it is either the amplitude envelope or possibly the chirp of the pulse that introduces the well-controlled steep gradient. With the advent of controlled light waves, and I'm going to address this a little bit in a little bit more detail just in a few minutes, a new signal gradient became available for both control and measurement. A signal gradient that varies on a sub-femtosecond scale, and it is originating directly from the very fast oscillation, very fast variation of the electric field of visible or near infrared light. We propose to refer to this new technology as light wave electronics by analogy with microwave electronics, just as microwave voltages of fields drive electric current in nanoscale circuits with the corresponding speed corresponding to the microwaves down to the picosecond regime. In light wave electronics, the electric field of visible or near infrared light drives atomic scale motion of electrons inside atoms or inside molecules on a correspondingly faster time scale. Let me just address how we have been able to produce the light waves that serve as a basic technology for ethosecond control and metrology. Basically, two key technologies have paved the way to them. On the one hand, ultra-broadband dispersion control, which are multi-layers, open the way to the routine generation of very short light pulses with a bandwidth spanning almost an octave, with a well-controlled amplitude envelope, but as you see here, with a poorly controlled or not at all controlled timing of the electric field oscillations with respect to the envelope, which is mathematically quantified by the so-called carrier envelope phase. It was the Nobel Prize-winning frequency comp technique of Ted Hench who eventually enabled us to stabilize this timing of the oscillations with respect to the envelope and in this way stabilize the waveform and allowed us to produce intense few cycle light waves with precisely reproducible evolution of the electric and of course also magnetic field. in an attempt to use these waves for triggering, inducing, and subsequently also controlling electronic motion inside atoms, we exposed atoms to these pulses and adjusted the intensity of the pulses such that the atoms have been ionized by the field. What then happens has been predicted long time ago by Paul Corkum in his famous paper in 93. He came up with a, and also Ken Schaefer, by the way, more or less the same time, came up with a so-called three-step model of strong field ionization, of strong field ionization by a linearly polarized laser field in the first step. The laser field, once it became strong enough, suppresses the Coulomb barrier and allows the electron to escape with some probability, the most weakly bound electron to escape with some probability. Then the next step is the motion in the laser field, and since the direction of the field is reversed in the next cycle, the electron may come back to the vicinity of the core and actually recollide with its parent ion. One of the consequences of this recollision is a possible recombination of the electron back into its ground state, upon which its kinetic energy must be released, and it is being released in the form of an energetic photon. Because the electrons may have very different energies at the instant of the recollision, the photon energies are also covering a broad range, ranging all the way from UV up to soft X-ray photon energies. In a few cycle wave, what is special is that we have just a few ionization and subsequent recollision events. Therefore, the peaks that you see here are not really genuine harmonics, as you are used to when you create this, when you induce this process by a long multi-cycle pulse, where this ionization and recollision is perfectly periodic, and consequently the emission spectrum of a periodic process consists of evenly spaced lines which constitute high order harmonics of the driving laser field. Here what we observe experimentally is that the position of these peaks shift just by shifting the carrier envelope phase of these pulses without touching any other pulse parameters. That means that, of course, these peaks have nothing to do with harmonics, because if they were harmonics, they should be locked to an integer multiple of the driver wave. But nevertheless, of course, the physics behind the generation process is exactly the same as in long pulses. I just have difficulties to refer to this this radiation high order harmonics under the conditions when we create them with a very short pulse, because actually there is nothing like harmonics in a spectrum when we measure it. Okay, so this is one point. The more important point is that in a few cycle wave, actually there is one recollision event which is at the zero, near the zero transition, following the pulse peak. The electrons which come back to the vicinity of the parent ion around this instant possess a significantly higher kinetic energy than all other electrons, and therefore if we filter out the highest energy photons from the emitted radiation, we expect them to originate from this single recollision event. This is at this point just an expectation, but this is what actually the strong field theory of Paul Corkum, Ken Schaefer, and others, and of course all the numerical calculations also support. So this may be the recipe for the generation of a single isolated sub-femtosecond XUV pulse. But of course, this is not quite as simple, because you immediately see if you switch to a sine wave, just shift the wave with respect to the envelope by pi over 2, the carrier envelope phase by pi over 2. You see that with the same laser pulse, for very obvious symmetry reasons, even in this highest photon energies, you will have contributions from at least two recollisions, because there is at least two trajectories that deliver the electrons back to the vicinity of the parent ion with the same kinetic energy. So from this it must be obvious that the control over the waveform is really, really a key issue to be able to control electronic processes and all concomitant phenomena like XUV emission within the wave cycle that is on a sub-femtosecond or attosecond timescale. Actually, XUV emission is not the only consequence of recollision. There is several other consequences. One of them is a backscattering of the returning electron. You can imagine it just like the electron can be bounced back from the electron that returns to the vicinity of the core can be bounced back from the parent ion just like a billiard ball, and can pick up pretty high kinetic energy this way. If we do this in a controlled way with a few cycle, with a waveform controlled few cycle pulse, we, for the same reasons as I told you before, we expect in the case of a cosine waveform one single electron trajectory which returns with the maximum energy and therefore is bounced back as a backscattered electron with the maximum energy, and that's exactly what you see here. By the way, these measurements have been performed by Gerhard Paulus and co-workers together with some of my colleagues by placing two detectors aligned opposite to each other with the laser field and detecting the electrons that have been ejected parallel to the laser field in the two opposite directions. So you see in the upper direction this black line clearly indicates that for a cosine pulse the spectrum, the energy spectrum of the electrons extends by quite a few EV more to higher energies than that of the electrons backscattered downwards. Now if we shift the carrier envelope phase by pi over 2, turn the laser, the waveform from cosine to sine, you see that the cutoff is exactly the same, becomes exactly the same. If we go a step further, add another pi over half to a phase shift in this way, basically just flip the electric field over so that at the center of the pulse the electric field doesn't point upwards but it points downwards, and we get exactly the opposite situation where the energy spectrum of the electrons backscattered downwards extend to higher energies than the other one, and so on and so forth. So this series of measurements demonstrates impressively that indeed with the waveform of this few cycle light wave, it is indeed possible to control the motion of electrons inside or around an atom on an angstrom length scale and the sub-femtosecond time scale. Actually, it also teaches us that this specific measurement technique may be extremely useful, provides a very simple and intuitive way of actually measuring the waveform, of determining the waveform. There is really nothing involved, complicated theory behind this. This is just simply, very, very simply classical physics. You just describe the electron like a billiard ball, and just Newton's equation tells us that for such a cosine pulse, the electron coming back upwards must possess a larger energy than the other one coming downwards, and so on and so forth. So basically, just based on this very simple intuitive model, we are allowed to determine the waveform. Now let me just come back to the XUV emission, because this is, I mean, in this case, of course, we also produce, at least we believe we produce sub-femtosecond electron pulses. So basically these backscattered electrons, if you would filter them properly, energetically, maybe just this last few electron volts, for sure would be confined, the emission would be confined to a fraction of a femtosecond. But of course, electron pulses very rapidly disperse because of the finite energy spread and are not easy to use sort of outside this atom. There have been a few beautiful experiments where these recollision electrons have been used for spectroscopy during the recollision, but it's hard to use them afterwards, just as a sort of independent source of electron pulses. For this purpose, the XUV pulses emitted from this recollision process lend themselves in a much better way. And therefore, we are, of course, interested in using them, but before we can use them, we have to characterize them. I just recapitulate very briefly how we have done that, just for the sake of those few of you who might not be familiar with what has been referred to as the attosecond streak camera. So I just start with the basic concept of the streak camera, which most of you know. Photoelectrons knocked off by the short pulse that we want to characterize are deflected by a transverse voltage ramp, and this voltage ramp varies linearly in time, maps basically the temporal distribution of this incident light pulse, which is the same as the temporal distribution of the photoelectron pulse, to a spatial distribution of the photoelectrons on a screen. This is what has been called a streak image, and this streak image within the resolution limits of this device basically displays mirrors the temporal intensity profile of the incident pulse, short pulse to be measured. State-of-the-art electron optical streak cameras achieve a resolution of around 100 femtoseconds. Now the question was, can this resolution be improved by a factor of 1,000 or something like that, to use the same concept for performing similar measurements on the XUV pulses, which are supposed to have a duration of just a few hundred attoseconds. Well, imagine that the photocathode is replaced by an ensemble of atoms, and the field, the microwave field that deflects the photoelectrons, replaced by a light field, a very rapidly varying light field. This means that electrons that are ejected at slightly different instants will pick up different, will gain a different amount of momentum and energy from this light field depending on the instant of release. So basically the light field streaks their final energy distribution, which can be very easily measured by a time of flight detector. And this is now what we call a streak image, but in this case not in real space, but in this case basically in energy or momentum space, whatever you choose here as a variable, basically for the electron count. So basically, what you end up with is a final photoelectron energy spectrum that is streaked in a way that, in this process, basically the temporal history of emission is encoded. Now you may wonder how it is encoded. In specific cases, we may choose actually a specific delay between or timing between the sub-femtosecond pulse to be measured and the streaking laser field in a way that from one single measurement under specific circumstances, we may get the information we are interested in. But I would like to emphasize that in this technique, this is not necessary, this restriction, because it is very easy we can implement the a variable delay between the streaking laser field and the XUV pulse to be measured very, very easily. So not only does this streaking field provide a sub-femtosecond signal gradient for measurements in the attosecond domain, also can we adjust the timing of this gradient with respect to the signal to be measured with attosecond accuracy. This means we can record a whole series of such streaked spectra at slightly different timing of the signal to be measured with respect to the streaking function or streaking signal. And I guess you can imagine that from such a series of spectra, we can learn much more than just from one single streak image. Here you see one such set of data, which has been compiled from a series of streaked photoelectron spectra. So basically each vertical slice of this false color represented data set constitutes a streaked photoelectron image, which has been measured at a specific delay between the XUV pulse knocking off the photoelectrons and the streaking laser field. Many of you will recognize in this something that you know very well from a technique that has been invented quite a few years ago and dubbed frequency resolved optical gating. This set of data is nothing else but a spectrogram. This is the same spectrogram what you measure in frequency resolved optical gating, with the only essential difference that the gating signal here is not the amplitude envelope of a femtosecond pulse like it is in the conventional implementation of FROG, but it is the oscillating field itself. And therefore, your resolution is now not limited by the steepness of the amplitude envelope of the laser pulse, which is several femtoseconds, but allows you to achieve a resolution down to the attosecond regime thanks to the sub-femtosecond gradient in your gating signal. So you know from the work of Rick Tabino and many others that such a spectrogram, if recorded with a sufficiently good signal-to-noise ratio, provides sufficient information to unambiguously retrieve both the gating function as well as the gated or sampled quantity, which is in our case the XUV pulse itself. In this particular case, this retrieval is particularly simple. Actually, without any cumbersome data analysis, you will figure out what you are seeing here. Since the spectrogram resembles the oscillations of the few cycle wave, it is obvious that the sampled event must be confined in time to a small fraction of the half oscillation period. Would this not be the case, these oscillations would be blurred. This is conclusion number one, without any cumbersome data analysis. So we can conclude that a single sub-femtosecond pulse must have been at work here. Conclusion number two, this sub-femtosecond pulse is synchronized to the few cycle wave used as a gating signal here with sub-femtosecond precision. The timing jitter must be much smaller than 1 femtosecond. Would this not be the case again, the oscillations could not be resolved because these data have been acquired during a large number of laser shots. So So would the XUV pulse jitter with respect to the fuse cycle wave from one laser shot to the next? Would it jitter by something like the half oscillation cycle? Of course, the accumulated signal would not show any resemblance to the oscillations anymore. So these are two very important conclusions. Now let's just move ahead and again refer to a simply classical analysis which can be done once the electron has been freed by the XUV pulse and starts moving in the streaking laser field. If we describe this motion classically, we conclude that the energy that an electron that is ejected parallel to the polarization direction of the laser field gains this amount of energy at the release time t, namely an energy that is equal to the product of the initial momentum of the electron, which it picks up, the corresponding energy it picks up from the XUV photon. So this can be controlled by the XUV photon energy, and the vector potential of the streaking field at the instant of release. So once we know this vector potential, and this is basically just this white line here, from that we can immediately determine the electric field of this pulse by just differentiating this vector potential with respect to time. So in this way, we obtain a laser pulse with a pulse duration of 4.3 femtoseconds. This is full width at half maximum, carried at a wavelength of 750 nanometers, which corresponds to a oscillation cycle of 2.5 femtoseconds. With the gating signal known, it is nothing simpler but determining the gated function. Actually, in this specific case, since it turns out we have a very well-behaved pulse, which is very close to its Fourier limit, it can be shown that it is enough to select just two streaked images taken at two adjacent zero transitions of the vector potential, which means two adjacent maxima of the laser field. And from that, together with the field-free spectrum, we can retrieve the pulse, both its amplitude envelope and a little bit of temporal chirp is also obvious, which, by the way, does not relate to a spectral phase, but it relates to some asymmetry in the spectrum. So we end up with the conclusion that we have here something like 250 attosecond XUV pulses, a single 250 attosecond XUV pulse that carried at a photon energy of around 95 eV. All right, how does the experimental system look like? We produce these pulses in neon gas. The radiation is produced in a nice collimated beam just because the process is highly coherent, just as every harmonic generation process, if you do it properly. And we reflect these two beams with a two-component mirror. This mirror serves several purposes. On the one hand, we can introduce a delay with this mirror, a delay of the XUV pulse with respect to the laser pulse with attosecond accuracy. Secondly, the central mirror, which reflects the XUV beam, also fulfills a filtering function. It reflects only light between the photon energies of 90 to 100 eV. So it makes sure that, as you can remember, just discussed before, that we select only photons that originate from one single recollision event in the strongly driven atom. Last but not least, these mirrors focus both pulses into a second a gas jet where the XUV pulse knocks off, in the street camera measurement, knocks off valence band photoelectrons, and these are accelerated or decelerated by this laser field, just as I explained you before, and the streaked electron spectra are just measured in this time of flight electron spectrometer. Now the important comment that I would like to make here is that this apparatus is not only suited for the metrology of the pulse itself, namely for characterizing the XUV pulse and the few cycle laser wave, just as I explained you before. But exactly the same apparatus can afterwards be used for attosecond spectroscopy. So the experiments that I'm going to show you now in the remaining few minutes have been done with exactly the same apparatus, with the only difference that in some cases the time of flight detector has been replaced by another detector, like a velocity map imaging detector or a reflectron observing ions of different charge states. But otherwise, the rest of the system was left the same. So this is how it looks like in reality. So basically, this is the laser in the back, and this is what we call the sort of latest generation attosecond beamline here. Another perspective. So this is the chamber where we generate the XUV light, and both beams, both the laser and the XUV beam, then propagate down this tube here to arrive in the second chamber where the actual experiments take place. The main improvement here has been, as compared to our previous beamlines, the vast improvement in vacuum conditions. So previously we thought that maybe we don't have to worry about vacuum too much because we introduce a lot of gas anyway for generating the harmonics, then for doing the street camera measurements. But it turns out that actually this gas is, of course, not a problem. So you can introduce the gas that you want to use in amounts whatever you want. The main thing is that that you can eliminate other kinds of materials, and for that purpose you should try to reduce the background pressure to levels possible. Okay, so let's now turn our attention to attosecond spectroscopy. So far we have selected a valence photoelectron emitted from some valence electronic state that responds essentially instantly to the incident XUV radiation, even on a sub-femtosecond timescale. This is what we have utilized in our streak camera measurement, because what we measure in our streaking measurement is, of course, not directly the temporal evolution of the XUV pulse, but the temporal evolution of this photo-emitted electron wave packet. And only if this photo-emission process responds nearly instantly to the incident XUV field can we assume that what we measure here is actually nothing else but the duration of the XUV pulse. So it can be shown that this is really a good approximation in all those cases where this measurement has been done in the past. Now, of course, the same thing, and this is what we have been referred to as the attosecond streak camera. Now, the same streaking concept can, of course, also be applied to processes like OG emission, where what happens is inner shell vacancy is filled by an electron knocking off a second electron, and the emission of this secondary electron or OG electron, the emission time of this OG electron is equal to the relaxation time, to the filling time of this inner shell vacancy. So now we can just go ahead and basically apply the same streaking technique to these electrons, to these OG electrons, and we are supposed to be able to learn the duration of emission of this OG electron, and from that the lifetime of the inner shell vacancy. Here you see a series of spectrograms calculated by Armin Skrinzy and co-workers in Vienna back in 2002 for different core hole vacancy lifetimes, ranging from a couple of hundred attoseconds up to several femtoseconds. You see, for very short lifetimes, the spectrogram resembles the one that we have taken with the photoelectrons. So basically the photoelectron spectrum is shifted up and down as the laser field, or its vector potential more precisely, oscillates. This is still visible up to something like 1 femtosecond, but actually the modulation or any variation of the streaked spectra within the wave cycle tends to gradually disappear as the whole lifetime becomes longer and longer and becomes eventually significantly longer than the wave cycle of the streaking field. So in this limit, what takes over the sampling function from the electric field is basically the envelope of the laser pulse. Because what you see here is the emergence of sidebands spaced by the laser photon energy from the main line, main Auger line, which is this one. And the appearance and disappearance of this sideband as a function of delay is the result of a convolution between the Auger emission process and the amplitude envelope of the laser pulse. So from just measuring the amplitude of the sideband as a function of delay and subsequent deconvolution, we can obtain the emission. And it is this regime where the first inner shell spectroscopic experiment has taken place, which yielded a lifetime of an M-shell 3D vacancy in krypton of about 8 femtoseconds. Of course, streaking is not only suitable for determining inner shell lifetimes. You could consider asking also other quite exciting questions. For instance, look at this situation here, where photoemission is actually core hole photoemission is accompanied by shake-up. What does this mean? The energy of the incident XUV photon is not completely transmitted to one single electron that is ejected, like in the case here, but a fraction of it is transmitted to another electron, which is promoted from another bound state. This is what people call shake-up. And in this context, we may ask the question how this shake-up actually occurs. Is the energy of the incoming photon instantly shared between the photoelectron and this excited electron, and the photoemission not affected by the shake-up? Or does the core electron first pick up the entire photon energy and transmits a fraction of it to another electron as it is coming out of the atom? These are two very different possibilities, and we may expect that in the second case, if this electron transfers a fraction of its energy to another one, maybe the emission time does not exactly look the same as in the case where all the photon energy is taken up by one single electron. So by comparing these two streaked spectra, maybe we can learn something about shake-up. Is there any other possibility of learning something about inner atomic excitation and relaxation processes directly in the time domain with these tools? There is also another possibility. Instead of probing the electrons that have been ejected from the atom, we can also use the laser field to promote originally bound electrons to positive energies and set them free by tunneling ionization. Now imagine if we do this with the shaken up electrons, then in this way, in principle, we may be able to measure either the shake-up process itself, or if it accompanies instantly some other process, be it photoemission, be it Auger emission, then this other process. What is the expected time resolution here? Well, if we are really able to induce this transition by means of tunneling, then Keldysh theory predicts that tunneling is confined to a tiny, very narrow time interval near the oscillation cycle where the field is maximum. the emission time is predicted to be just a tiny fraction of the half oscillation period. So we expect the ionization going on step-like, and if we can see the steps, then these steps can be used as a probing function for probing any sorts of inner shell or intra-atomic relaxation or excitation processes. First of all, we have to check whether this tunneling really takes place, whether before we can consider the possibility of using it for attosecond time-resolved spectroscopy. To this end, we have first selected a system where actually this core level photoemission could not take place to avoid the possibility of Auger relaxation, which might complicate the whole dynamics. So we would like now to see a situation where basically the XUV pulse comes in, ionizes the atom, and during this ionization, with some probability, shakes up bound electrons into this state. And this is what we would like to extract with our laser pulse that is coming in a time-delayed fashion. The intensity of the laser pulse is adjusted such that it cannot ionize neutral atoms with a larger ionization potential. In the case of neon, the ionization potential is 21.5 electron volts. By shake-up, we can populate states with binding energy in the range of 10 eV. So we can adjust the laser field strength in such a way that we can reach these states, but we can't ionize neutral neon. That's exactly what we have done. And here you see the result. The result shows us that indeed, just as we expected and Kerdish predicted some 40 years ago, we see the very nice and clear steps. Near the individual oscillation peaks of the probing laser field. We can also go on and do measurements where we change the carrier envelope phase of the laser pulse. This is here, and if you take a close look, we'll not have time for taking a very close look, but you just have to believe me that in the case of the red curve, we have something like four steps. In the case of the blue curve, we have rather three steps, again, exactly as we expect from the symmetry considerations of the two pulses of a cosine and sine wave. And here we just zoom in into the central few femtoseconds, and you can very clearly see each half cycle there is quite a significant step upwards in the ionization probability. From this, we can set a very safe upper limit for tunneling and shake-up of around 400 attoseconds. Probably this is a very conservative estimate, and probably the real response times are significantly shorter. Now with this working, we can take the next step and now apply this tunneling process for probing an Auger relaxation. Now we choose a system in which we produce a core hole by our XUV pulse. This system is in this case xenon. So basically the incident XUV pulse just ionizes xenon, produces a single charge xenon atom. Now an Auger process follows, which produces a double charged xenon atom. And during this Auger process, also shake-up occurs. Now we probe this shaked-up electron by the tunneling transition that we can induce with the time-delayed probe laser pulse. And here you see the result, xenon 3+ is the final product, because this guy here makes this electron tunnel, so makes from xenon 2+ to xenon 3+. But this process can take place only after this electron has appeared here, has been shaken up. It is being shaken up by the Auger process. So the Auger decay must precede the probing. So from that it follows that basically the rise time of the signal contains the Auger relaxation time. And this is exactly the case. From this rise time we can extract a 6 femtosecond Auger relaxation time, single Auger decay, which fits perfect frequency domain data. Actually, we can go even a step further. From frequency domain measurements, we also know that in this system, single Auger decay is also accompanied by double Auger decay. So basically, the atom can relax back into its lowest energy state also by a cascaded Auger process, which actually produces as an end state xenon 3 plus rather than 2 plus. Of course, we don't see it here, because here with the laser we also produce xenon 3 plus, so the function is the same. Therefore, we have switched to xenon 4 plus, which is also with a small probability produced by the laser, either by sequential or non-sequential double ionization. And here we see beautifully the decay of the signal, which is nothing else but the lifetime of the double Auger process, which amounts to 29 femtoseconds. And this is the very first measurement of this double Auger lifetime. Actually, it's quite paradoxical that attosecond spectroscopy has, for the first time, measured something that frequency domain spectroscopy could not reveal at long times. Why is that? Because the longer the lifetime becomes, the narrower the corresponding spectrum. And the frequency domain people at some point, of course, get limited by the resolution of their photoelectron spectrometry. So basically, in this case, the French group that characterized this in the frequency domain just a couple of years ago could set only an upper limit of, a lower limit of 23 femtoseconds for this, based on the resolution or limited by the resolution of their spectrometer. This is basically nothing new. They have been able to determine this from domain data very, very accurately. Okay, now I guess my time is almost over, but let me just address this very last point very quickly. So far, all measurements have been all attosecond spectroscopic measurements have been realized in the gas phase on isolated systems. This prompts the question whether this technology might be extendable to solids. The motivation is very clear. There is a wealth of electron phenomena in solids which take place on a time scale of a few femtoseconds or shorter. Just think of things like charge screening in metals, electron-electron scattering of hot electrons, short-lived transient excitons which have been predicted in metals during the time before charge screening sets in, charge transfer on the surface from a molecule to the bulk, basically host gas processes, and so on and so forth. So there is really, really a tremendous variety of questions out there which wait to be answered once there is a suitable spectroscopic tool for that. The question is, might any of these spectroscopies be suitable for that? Tunneling spectroscopy we can probably exclude very easily, because in a solid we have states, not just virtual but real states, very close to the vacuum level. So it is very likely that the that upon applying a strong field, the electron chooses to undergo this transition by tunneling. Rather, it will just go up by single photon transitions. It will find levels there which it can use, just sort of reside intermediately and then take the next step. And of course, this process is very slow. Basically, this would extend over the entire laser pulse, so this would not give us attosecond resolution. That's at least what I think. Maybe you correct me. So let's just focus ourselves to attosecond streaking. There is no reason why this should not work, at least in principle. Unfortunately, in practice, there is reasons why it might be difficult, at least. The working function in a solid is very small as compared to the ionization potential of atoms. That means that at a fairly low electric field strength, this guy here will start extracting electrons by multiphoton or thermal photoemission, which is not what we want in streaking spectroscopy. We want to use this probing pulse, of course, just for free transitions after the electron has been set free by the XUV pulse. So it turns out that There is at least for our currently available 95 electron volt XUV photon energy, just a very, very narrow range, a parameter range for the laser intensity where streaking may be strong enough, but you do not extract, you do not ionize the system by the laser so strongly that basically everything is buried in ATI electrons. So yeah, I'm just about to wrap up. So just let me close with showing you this result, which was acquired by Adrian Cavalieri just a few weeks ago, a postdoc who joined us from Phil Wachsbaum group from Stanford and has been working on this for almost a year, and the project has came several times to a point where we were discussing whether we should stop it or go ahead. Fortunately, we didn't stop. So at last, he managed to produce a beautiful streaking of both conduction band electrons coming directly from the Fermi edge in this system, which was tungsten in this case, as well as core hole electrons, which come from the 4F state of tungsten. We did not have time yet for retrieving the temporal behavior of these electrons, but it is quite obvious that it must be sub-femtosecond, because otherwise you would not see the waves here. And the interesting question is certainly whether the two electrons behave the same, whether the laser, for instance, does some heating on the conduction band electrons and maybe induces a delayed response, whereas the core electrons cannot be reached by the laser and therefore they are emitted just as they are supposed to be by determined basically by the XUV pulse. Okay, so let me just go ahead and to my last transparency. And acknowledge, okay. So finally, I would like to acknowledge the contribution of many, many dedicated and highly motivated young co-workers who are listed here. I don't have the time to quote them all by names. And of course, also a number of collaborators without whose contributions these results could not have been achieved. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you very much. Yeah, this is a very good point. That's what I mentioned before, that we really have to make sure that we select specific valence band photoelectrons that have a fast enough response. Now the question is apparently how to figure out whether the response is fast enough. Fortunately enough, to this end, you don't have to do any time domain experiment. All you have to do is to look at the transition probabilities as a function of photon energy, and these data are available from synchrotron measurements. If this transition probability is flat over the photon energy range that you are interested in, then you basically know that the response is instantaneous. If it shows some wide structure, then you should be very, very careful. Mm-hmm. You mean afterwards, after the electron is emitted? Oh, well, that's, thank you, that's another very good point. So actually, it is very, very essential that the interaction takes place right after the electron comes out. So there is no time left for the electron to propagate. The interaction time is, you know, the few femtoseconds determined by the laser pulse, and you can calculate how far the electron propagates during these few femtoseconds. An electron with a kinetic energy of roughly 100 eV, but it could actually be even higher, this will not travel a substantial distance. So basically, this is really very important, and thank you very much for this question. This is another essential difference, very important difference between the traditional street camera and the atomic version of the street camera. Because in the traditional street camera, even if you could speed up the deflection voltage somehow, you might think that basically it is the microwave deflection voltage that doesn't allow you to achieve high resolution. This is wrong. This would not help if you would speed it up. The problem is that the electrons that come out of the photocathode come out, of course, with an finite energy distribution, and they immediately start to spread also in time. And by the time they start interacting with the microwave field and they eventually arrive on the screen, of course, they suffer a lot from this initial energy spread. Now, in the atomic implementation, this energy spread is encoded in the process. This is not a limitation. And this is not a limitation because you apply the field immediately.
I have a question about one of your last points, which I think you said that it's very difficult to do an optical field emission experiment from a solid because of the presence of lots of levels, and so you've done it by multiphotons. So a couple of comments on that. First of all, clearly, the DC field emission is the field line microscope, so this happens from
At least in certain solids. I mean, probably not in all of them, but yeah, I agree. That's right.
I think that Cassidy and Polhoff have been studying this problem. I think that they just recently had a publication where they claimed that they could see both. They could differentiate the multiphotons from the field. I could be wrong about that.
Do you mean the paper where they illuminated the tip with a short pulse? I'm not sure about that, but maybe I didn't read it carefully enough. Mm-hmm. But this is, I mean, maybe I was not properly understood. So this is a very good point. I was not trying to say that the attosecond tunneling spectroscopy may not be extendable to any specific system. This might possibly work with some selected systems, but may not be that easily generalizable as the attosecond streaking spectroscopy for a wide range of systems. Because in many cases, thermionic or thermal or basically single photon cascaded transitions might be the dominant channel, and then of course you will not have an attosecond resolution. That's right.
So the question I would put as a general question is, where will we win?
We will win as soon as we are so far that we can leave the domain of proof of principle measurements. We feel safe enough that our measurement system is doing exactly what we want it to do. We are not at that stage yet. We are just trying to learn and trying to gain confidence. Once we have come to this point, there is a wealth of dynamics where the final state of the process can be reached through different channels. In this very moment, you will have to do with interfering quantum transitions. And this also immediately implies very complicated structures in the spectral domain. And from these complicated structures in the spectral domain, it is usually very, very difficult to retrieve unambiguously the temporal evolution. It looks like they are. Well, it looks like they are modulated in phase, but okay. But I'm not sure I would interpret this as something like phase-locked electrons. I mean, their energy spectrum is streaked after they come out, and basically what you see here, the more or less, in-phase oscillations is just a consequence of the fact that the electric field acts on both electrons in the same way. So I'm not sure from this we can say anything about the relative coherence of the two electrons, but maybe I'm wrong. So, at least what we can of course learn is that they appear in the continuum in a very similar way. So the time structure in both cases seem to be sub-femtosecond, but whether there is any differences once we take a closer look, we'll have to wait until we have done the analysis of the spectrogram, which has not happened yet.
You always talk about the use of the auto second pulse to pump the system, and then you use the IR to destroy it. When the other around is the current technology?
Whether we can turn the rolls around, you mean?
Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. Actually, this gives me the opportunity to show you one of the transparencies that I actually wanted to show you. If you ask me where could be the next frontier, I would tend to say to extend attosecond technologies to biological processes. One of such processes of really, really central importance is charge transfer in biomolecules. Would understand how this happens, we would probably understand how biological signal transmission occurs, or how the detailed elementary mechanisms behind the damage or repair of a DNA molecule looks like. So this is really of central importance, and François Remarquel and Raphael Levine have shown just few months ago in this publication that under certain conditions a charge transfer, basically transferring an electron or a hole from one end of a biomolecule to the other, can take place within sub-femtoseconds. And not only that, what is even more exciting, that it looks like our currently available attosecond tools may also allow us to probe this, because what they have also calculated, this is unpublished, so you will not find this in the paper, by now sending in a time-delayed XUV pulse, let's just take our 250 attosecond 95 EV XUV pulse, this is what they have used in their calculations. What you see is how the photoelectron spectrum looks like as this electron moves from one end of the molecule to the other. So you see there is a very, very clear variation, a very significant variation, which might allow us to probe this process and to observe this process in real time. So this is exactly the type of spectroscopy you have mentioned. Here we would use the few cycle pulse or some derivatives of it, some frequency converted, maybe UV, very short UV pulse to create this charge here by some localized UV transition in the molecule, and then probe the process by time delayed XUV pulse. Perturbed by what?
By your
This was a very good comment. I think our theory colleagues are now challenged. That's correct. In this case, you really have to make this check and also make sure that either you understand how this influence looks like or create experimental conditions where this influence can be neglected. Now, what helps us is the following. We were also quite worried about this. We're worried about the fact that maybe in shake-up we populate very highly excited bound states, very close to the vacuum level, which you can extract by absorbing maybe one photon or two photons. In this case, of course, there is no chance for realizing a transition, for making tunneling the dominant channel, which will spoil your time resolution completely. And these are also the electrons that are most susceptible, of course, to the influence of the external field. The more weakly they are bound, the more susceptible they are to external fields. So what saves us is apparently the fact that in most systems, the population induced by shake-up more or less exponentially declines with increasing energy. So in the specific systems that we have looked at so far, the dominant population emerges at levels with binding energy of at least 10 eV or more. Above that, the population is just a percent or less of the others. Maybe there is other cases where this is not the case, but at least in the systems that we have looked at. Well, this is our probing process, right? Or what kind of? I mean, this is what eventually makes the electron tunnel, or? Okay, I'm not so sure. I mean, we have to create conditions where we do not reach the electrons in the neutral atom. I'm talking to you, but you don't listen to me. so we realize experimental conditions where the electric field is not strong enough to reach the electron, even the most loosely bound electron in the neutral atom. It just doesn't do anything. So that means, at least this is what I conclude from that, that basically down at that level, the laser doesn't do anything. So now we excite the atom, which induces some shake-up, and this is what we probe. So what exactly, I mean, we can be at least sure that below the shake-up levels, the laser doesn't do anything. I agree with you that we have to be very careful about the population dynamics of shake-up, and have to check very carefully that we do not populate very high high levels close to the vacuum level, because then the situation gets really messed up. I agree with you, but as long as we can make sure that we populate levels with a pretty large binding energy, and this seems to happen in most cases, I think we are pretty safe.